One in five women have been sexually assaulted in college. It's according to a new White House report. What's being done to combat this problem in Iowa? It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Yesterday, President Obama formally set up a task force that's charged with protecting students. We'll find out what's being done in our state. Also this hour, we'll hear about a new commission here in Iowa to help schools with core academic standards. We'll talk with IPR's Pat Blank about the propane shortage, those high prices, and what something called the Alberta Clipper has to do with this frigid, cold weather. First, the news from NPR. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer, and perhaps you heard me tell you we would be talking with award-winning TV journalist Soledad O'Brien today. Well, our weather threw a frosty wrench into those works. It delayed her flight to Iowa, so we hope to have her discussion with her next week on the program. But plenty of conversation this hour from all sorts of news items relevant to us here in the Midwest. Yesterday, President Obama formally set up a task force that's charged with protecting students from sexual assault. We'll hear what the local scene is here, how Iowa students are in danger of sexual assault and what's being done to prevent it. We'll also talk with IPR's Pat Blank about this propane shortage. Perhaps you live in a rural area where you don't have the gas pipeline of natural gas and you rely on propane. You certainly have noticed the shortage and the incredibly high prices of propane. We'll find out why from Iowa Public Radio's Pat Blank later in the hour. Also, weather-wise, what something called the Alberta Clipper has to do with this very cold streak of weather we've been having and what we have in store for us this weekend and into the coming week. But first, a new commission to help schools with core academic standards. The director of the Iowa Department of Education has appointed a new 21-member commission to help schools with what are called the core academic standards. Iowa was the last state in the nation to adopt statewide standards in 2008, standards that establish what students are expected to learn in such areas as mathematics, English, language arts, science, and social studies, all the way from kindergarten through the 12th grade. Joining me now to discuss this, Tom Downs, executive director of the Iowa Association of School Boards. He's been a superintendent, a high school principal, teacher, to name a few of the roles he's filled. Tom Downs, welcome to our program.
Thanks, Ben. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon to you. And good afternoon to D.T. McGee, executive director of the Iowa Board of Educational Examiners. D.T. McGee, welcome to you.
Well, thank you for having me today.
You've also served in numerous roles in public education in Iowa, going back to the early 1990s. Tom Downs, let me start with you. For those not familiar with it, explain the Iowa Core. Give us some background on this.
Well, the department director, Brad Buck, formed the commission recently, and it's a group of advisors, if you will, including educators and leaders of education associations, myself, Dan Smith from the School Administrators Association, Mary Jane Cobb from the Iowa State Education Association, business leaders, Department of Education staff, and other Iowa educators who are interested in seeing the Iowa Core successfully implemented.
Mm-hmm. Why do we need a core?
Well, it's been, I think, a challenge in education circles to respond to the critics of why our student achievement has not improved as rapidly as other states. You know, we've all been proud of Iowa being the first in the nation. And we've heard recently, all in this ed reform discussion, that something's missing. And what we've discovered is missing is a clear set of academic standards that are going to require rigorous expectations from kids, a focus on achievement. And I think having a central statewide set of standards is the key component to addressing that concern and responding in a way that will, again, put us first in the nation.
I neglected to mention that you, Tom Downs, and D.T. McGee are both members of this new commission. D.T. McGee, talk about the subjects that are chosen. Why these subjects?
Well, we're starting off math and science specifically, and as we move forward, certainly the focus of a lot of efforts, including literacy, are what the major concern of for not only Governor Branstad, but for our state in general. And so we're starting off with those core academic subjects, and I'll include social studies as well. And so as we move forward, we want to focus on that core and then expand out from there as necessary.
Mm-hmm. Perhaps you can give us a little bit of sense, DT, of how this core has changed. I just remember from growing up, being educated at a public school here in Iowa, and also having three children who have gone through the public school system, that these things change over time. Can you give us a sense of how they've changed? You've been involved in Iowa public schools for quite some time.
Yes, Iowa has a long history and a proud history of local control, and is that has certainly served Iowa well. But as we see, there's some dynamic models that are out there, and other states have pursued those models that say there's a dynamic that you can get into, and I'll use the terminology loose and tight dynamic, where the state will step in and be very tight on some of the standards that are in place, but loose on how it's implemented at the local level. And so we have research and models are out there that are making some great progress in states in improving student achievement. So as we move forward, what we want to do is avoid some of the work that's been done in the past that's duplicative in nature. For example, I was a building level principal for 10 years, and local districts were responsible for writing standards. And so that involved a lot of time, a lot of effort, a lot of expense on local districts' parts. And generally what would happen is you'd get a group of districts together, usually with assistance from the AEA, and we would write standards, and they would generally wind up looking very similar. And so what we're hopeful for is that with this commission and assistance from the Department of Ed and guidance from the legislature and the governor's office, that we can set a set of standards, saving districts time in creating their own standards, and they can spend their time and efforts on implementing and choosing curriculum and instructional strategies that will effectively implement the core.
Mm-hmm. So this should be seen as school districts, not as sort of locked in or a straitjacket of core things, but they should see it. They are seeing it with relief. Can you say that?
I certainly think it'll provide them relief with having to once again go through the work of creating their own standards.
Mm-hmm. Explain Tom Downs, the relationship between this new 21-member commission, of which you both are members, between your commission and the school districts around Iowa. What authority does the commission have?
Well, the function of the commission really is twofold, or I should say our objectives. We're going to create and implement a comprehensive communication plan that addresses for Iowans the concerns that have been expressed probably as much politically as anything about what the core isn't. In other words, there's been an attack on the Common Core. But this Iowa core is developed by Iowans. It aligns with what we know research says academic standards should be for students who are in the top performing schools, not only in our country, but across the world. The other function of this particular commission is to create those toolkits and those resources that through the area education agencies to help teachers and school districts implement the core with fidelity. We're going to help put this into practice successfully across the state. And I think, you know, DT's comment earlier about what it is, it's not a one-size-fits-all approach. And it's a clear set of critical high-level academic standards. But locally, districts will determine how they teach it. Teachers will still determine their lesson plans. Mm-hmm. The standards are not going to prescribe that every student uses the same textbook or every teacher teaches the same lesson the same way.
Can you, Tom Downs, elaborate on that, Tom Downs, and communicate to me how, and take one specific area. I don't know, care if it's mathematics or language arts, but how is a standard communicated firmly in it, and so that it's clear what is expected statewide as a standard, but then allows a school district to fulfill it with flexibility?
Okay. I'm a former English teacher, a high school language arts teacher. One of the shifts from what we've had before to this Iowa core standard in language arts, one example might be in reading and writing. The demands today for students to be successful in a vocational career or in college and university work requires a high level of complexity in what students are able to read and interpret and then express in writing, in speaking, and in use of media and technology. The standard establishes a staircase that demands that they have knowledge in those areas, but the textbooks, the lessons, the how you get to that standard and how it's evaluated locally are all determined locally. Mm-hmm. We're looking as a commission, are there some examples that we can provide districts that align with the standard? Not that we're mandating any particular lesson plan or activity. Mm-hmm. Same in mathematics, you know, the concept skills around computation that we've all taught with basic arithmetic. Now we're looking at focusing on connecting those concepts from one grade level to the next. We're looking at far more than arithmetic. We're looking at applying mathematical concepts in real-world situations and having a deep understanding. And it's going to require, for example, in high school, students to have much more than just basic algebra. It truly is raising the level of rigor for our students, and we believe raising the expectations for both students and teachers.
D.T. McGee, talk about more about the effect that you think this commission and the course academic standards established will have on decision-making about instruction and curriculum in local school districts. How does it change on the ground in the local school districts in other ways?
Well, I think it gives districts the ability to collaborate, first of all, within their own districts, but then also with other districts. So you can come in and have common conversations about the same standards and then focus on what are the best curricular materials to select, what are the best instructional strategies to implement so that we raise student achievement levels. So before you would be in District A and your standards would look a little bit different for than standards B or the standards for District B that's 7 or 8 miles down the road. And that would maybe for third grade math. And so when you would get together, maybe in an AEA training or a professional development opportunity, you couldn't have some of those rich conversations because mm-hmm. you're talking about different standards. And so this will help to solve some of those issues. I would echo certainly what Director Downs said in that this is a great opportunity to increase the expectations for Iowa students and to allow them to focus their efforts in a way that they can accomplish that goal.
Tom Downs, how do you think these core standards will affect assessment in Iowa? You talked about putting Iowa on top again.
Well, one of the concerns the commission's looking at already, that the Iowa Core Commission, is that the state's current assessment system for students is not aligned with the standards of the Iowa Core. The department is keenly aware of the gaps that exist between the two, and we're currently very involved in reviewing the Iowa test. There's a task force in the state right now that's studying our whole assessment system. Until we get a test that can really evaluate students' success in meeting those standards, it's going to be difficult to show Iowa and show moms and dads and parents and politicians that we're making progress. So the legislature certainly knows that the assessment needs to be redesigned to align with the core. The governor knows that. Right now, again, we're studying that and looking at that as a state. There's a charge to bring a recommendation forward to the task force in another year, and the department's been very involved in a consortium of states looking at how do we prepare an assessment or a test, if you will, to determine that our kids are having success, mm-hmm. and how are we ever going to evaluate teachers on their students' performance unless that measurement, that test, is aligned with what they're teaching.
That assessment aspect seems really key here.
Critically important.
Any timeline for getting rid of the mismatch that you've described?
Well, again, right now we're just working with the Iowa testing people and working with educators across the state to analyze where are those gaps between the core and the current testing system. I know the Iowa Testing Service has a new form coming out within a year that they've communicated is aligned. We're looking forward to seeing that piloted and brought forward to schools in the near future.
We have with us DT McGee and Tom Downs talking about the two members of a new 21-member commission to help schools with what are called core academic standards. We have them for a few more minutes, but if you'd like to join our conversation, 1-866-780-9100. Rachel joins us from Ames. I understand you're an educator, I see on my screen, Rachel.
Yes, I am. I created some lesson plans which helped use the Common Core Standard using Shakespeare, actually, during my graduate program, and I'd love a way to share them with other educators, but I haven't found a format to do that.
Mm. Okay. Perhaps Tom or DT can suggest what can we tell Rachel?
Well, we're working as a commission to help develop and provide some of these types of resources that we can share with teachers that really focus on the scope and sequence at each grade level. So I would encourage Rachel to share those with her AEA or have her administrator share those with the Department of Education and their staff there who are leading this effort and facilitating this commission, who would be more than interested in looking at that. We actually have, Rachel, the two teachers in Iowa who co-chair the the State Council of Teachers of English and Language Arts on the commission, and I would encourage you also to consider contacting them.
Okay,
hey, wonderful.
Rachel, thank you for your call from Ames. I wonder, when we come up with, quite a task to come up with core academic standards, I'm sure, but I wonder if among teachers, DT McGee, maybe I can throw this to you, among teachers, administrators, and school boards, is there agreement about something more fundamental about the purpose of education?
Is there agreement?
Is there a broad agreement at that level, just the purpose of education? For instance, earlier in the discussion it was mentioned, are these kids going on to, we don't know if they're going on to higher education or vocational thing, they're going to leave high school and get right into the workforce?
Sure. I think there is broad agreement around the fact that we want to produce or create a college or high school graduates who are productive members of society and have the ability to learn during their lifetime. We know that most of our students that are graduating will experience multiple jobs and potentially multiple careers throughout their lifetime, which will require new learning. And so I think there is about that. When you start to get into some of the details of the Iowa Core, that's where some of the conversations occur. And that's part of why certainly the commission was convened, is to help facilitate some of those discussions and help to set up a communication network and a framework to allow the Iowa Core to be modified as we move forward based on feedback that we'll receive from educators and school districts, parents, and other interested stakeholders.
Now, in coming up with these core academic standards, Tom Downs, how much are we looking to other states? I mentioned in the introduction that Iowa was the last state in the nation to adopt statewide standards in 2008. So we have we're behind the pack, right?
Well, right now we are fortunate that we're part of a grant that includes four other rural states, and we'll be working with them and learning from them as they implement the Common Core within their states. But I wouldn't say we're behind. We're certainly one of the last states, if not the last, to implement statewide standards. And that's the hurdle we needed to get over. And
how did that come to pass that we were at the end?
I think that came to pass because for years, Iowans have been proud of this local control principle, PLE, the belief that all decisions should be made at the local level, but we found from that there's such an inequity imbalance across the state as you go from district to district based on lots of variables that we needed some high-class worldwide standards that are going to let our students compete globally, that are going to require higher and more rigorous expectations in the classroom, and I think our teachers are well-versed and prepared to deliver that. I think there's a comfort here that the teachers now will see a roadmap And as Director Buck said, as he formed the commission, this will give peace of mind for parents that there's going to be a rigorous set of academic standards as the foundation of all the work we're doing in Iowa to prepare our kids for college and career ready. And it's going to help all students.
Mm-hmm. You talked about inequity across the state as being a spur here to get a core academic standards across the state. Talk more about that, Tom Downs. What sorts of inequities did we have from school district to school district in the state?
Well, clearly we know with the infrastructure that is now being looked at by the governor and the legislature, I mean, access to online learning, access to technology, access to a variety of course offerings in math and science, in foreign languages, is limited sometimes just by scope and volume of numbers and budget. And Iowa's current foundation that funds schools based on its student enrollment, those that are declining obviously are going to have to make some tougher choices to continue to provide programs. And we don't want Iowans to reach that minimum bar, which we've always looked at. Here are the minimum standards. This Iowa Core creates a higher set of standards for all of us, and it's going to force and require us to stick with this roadmap, regardless of the size of our district, regardless of the level of demographic that might challenge us.
Mm-hmm. D.T. McGee, technology mentioned in that last answer by Tom Downs. A lot of technological changes happening in our classrooms, smart boards, fewer textbooks. Can you give us a look into the future in terms of technology and how that is part of the discussion of core academic standards?
Well, I would frame it this way. In the past, not all Iowans had access to indoor plumbing and to telephones and to electricity. And if sewer service or some other type of waste management. And so now you have broadband access, which is becoming a critical component, not only for education, but from an economic development standpoint for our state. And so we need to really frame it around that. It's a utility that will allow our students access to resources that are becoming more and more prevalent within our learning environments across the state. And so the governor's broadband initiative is being supported by a broad-based coalition throughout the state of Iowa so that we can bring a high level of broadband access to not only students in the state, but also our communities and citizens.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's just, from my standpoint, and I have three students right now that are currently enrolled in a public school district here in Iowa, that they have access to these resources, and that they have those, and also other students around the state have equal access. So they are not wanting for those resources that are readily available that will help them improve and increase their learning.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so I guess the simple answer I was looking for is technology a part of the standards? And you communicate a minimum technological standard in what you're doing?
Well, from an Iowa Core standpoint, we're really looking at what academic standards we have. How that's going to be delivered will be up to the local school districts. We just know that technology enhances those efforts.
Okay, very good. We've run out of time. D.T. McGee, thank you very much. Executive Director of the Iowa Board of Educational Examiners. Tom Downs, Executive Director of the Iowa Association of School Boards. Thank you for your time.
Thank you.
Thank you much, Ben.
Coming up in just a moment, we continue with three items that we still want to talk about. One in five women have been sexually assaulted in college. That's according to a new White House report. Coming up when we return, we'll talk about how this problem is being combated at Iowa's colleges and universities. Also, the propane shortage, the high prices there, and what the Alberta Clipper has to do with this frigid cold we've been having and what it looks like for the days to come. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. Great to have you with us on this frigid day in January. I'm Ben Kiefer. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. Well, the Cedar Rapids, Waterloo area was recently deemed one of the least Bible-minded cities in the U.S., Bible-mindedness being a combination of how often respondents read the Bible and how accurate they think the Bible is. Tomorrow on this program, as a part of our News Buzz program, Bible expert Robert Cargill will join the program to discuss his research and what it says this research. It wasn't his research. This research, he'll tell us about it and what it says about us here in Iowa. Also tomorrow, we'll talk about the recent string of home invasions and shootings in the Des Moines area. Also, I'll have on the program Iowa Secretary of State Matt Schultz, and also another danger as far as our news buzz tomorrow. Iowa recently being ranked as one of the most dangerous states to drive in. Can you believe that? I'm not sure I do. We'll find out about that tomorrow. One in five women, that's the number of women who have been sexually assaulted in college, according to a new White House report. Yesterday at the White House, President Obama formally set up a task force that's charged with protecting students.
It is estimated that one in five women on college campuses has been sexually assaulted during their time there. One in five. These young women worked so hard just to get into college. Often their parents are doing everything they can to help them pay for it. So when they finally make it there, only to be assaulted, that is not just a nightmare for them and their families. It's an affront to everything they've worked so hard to achieve.
President Obama yesterday at the White House's Council on Women and Girls presented its report on sexual assault, calling it an epidemic, especially on college campuses. Joining me to talk about this in our Iowa City studio, Linda Stewart-Krohn, director of the Women's Resource and Action Center at the University of Iowa. Linda, welcome back to our program.
Thank you, Ben.
What did you think of this speech and this new initiative by the president?
You know, it certainly raises the profile of the issue, I think, on the national stage. Vice President Biden, of course, has been involved in efforts to curb violence against women for a number of years. He was one of the authors of the original Violence Against Women Act. But to have the president now raising the profile of the issue and really allocating both his energy and time and resources to it is rather encouraging for those of us who are working in the field to prevent this kind of violence.
You are, as you say, have been for many years working in the field, and this is one of the many areas of concern that you have for women especially. How does this change your life, or how do you expect it to change your life, the creation of this task force?
You know, time will tell in terms of what the task force reports in terms of its recommendations. But certainly this is not the first step that this administration has taken in raising the profile of the issue. A number of letters have been sent to college campuses across the country providing more detailed guidance on how to approach these issues. Resources have been allocated to campuses, including our own, through a grant program in the Department of Justice to really improve our efforts, both to respond to victims of this kind of violence and to prevent it.
That's an astounding figure thrown out. One in five women sexually assaulted in college. How does that measure here in Iowa? Do you measure that? How can you measure that?
It's a very difficult number to measure. Sexual assault is an astoundingly underreported crime. Most victims of sexual assault, the vast majority of victims, never report to police. They are most likely to tell a friend or acquaintance.
So how do we know one in five?
Yeah. Well, I'm not a social scientist, so I can't tell you how that data is extrapolated in great detail. But I can tell you that victims report in a number of ways. So there are a number of streams for that data to come in. The kinds of things that are informally reported to offices like my own, for instance, I will often see students coming in saying something happened to my friend, I'm concerned about my roommate, or even that something has happened to them, but they don't yet know what they want to do about it. Here in Iowa City, we have a terrific rape crisis response program through the Rape Victim Advocacy Program, and they do compile very detailed statistics year upon year. And while they don't have numbers that show that every one of those one in five women has contacted them, there's a steady increase. And I don't think that reflects
in reporting.
In reporting. I don't think that necessarily can be interpreted as an increase in incidents. We don't know that. Mm. But what we are encouraged by is that people who are experiencing this kind of harm are seeking and receiving the kind of help that they need.
What can you tell us about the other side of this equation, the type of person who is most commonly the assailant?
There's a particular dynamic among assailants on college campuses, and that's actually noted in the task force's report that most college victims, first of all, are assaulted by someone they know. They may know them well, or it may be a more recent acquaintance, and that those assailants are often serial offenders. So it's almost a predatory pattern of behavior, looking for a victim who may be incapacitated, maybe under the influence of alcohol or another substance, who's socially isolated from their peers and thus has less ability to reach out to others for help. And it appears that there's a pattern. There's been some research done by David Lisak and other folks in the field who've interviewed these folks who've been caught to ask them about their pattern. And the average number of assaults committed by these folks against college victims is 6. So it's a really tiny number of people committing these assaults, but they're committing multiple assaults.
And when they talk about these serial offenders or talk with these serial offenders, what do they find out is at the core of it?
Right.
It is a sexual urge? Is it a power play?
You know, it's really not much of a sexual crime. We call it a sexual offense, but it's really a crime of power. It's a crime of asserting one's will against someone else. And Carla Miller, the executive director of RVAP, I have heard quoted talking about sexual assault as a crime of selfishness. It's the desire on the part of the assailant to get what they want at the expense of another person. And that describes it, I think, fairly well.
Mm-hmm. And the impact this have on the young women, 1 in 5 in college, can range from what to what?
It is a traumatic event in the life of a victim. It is certainly disruptive to their physical health and their mental health. Frequently, it impacts their ability to continue as students. It'll impact their ability to maintain social relationships. It's a wide-ranging set of effects that happens to victims, and it's often long-term.
Mm-hmm. Now, some will say that there's a real gray area in some cases about what is consensual sex and what is not. What do you say to that?
You know, there's one really good way to clear up that gray area, and that's to make sure that if you're engaging in some kind of sexual intimacy with another person, to make sure that you have clear and unambiguous consent from them. Clear, I like to call it clear enthusiastic consent. Then there's no gray area.
Okay. What will it take to change the larger problem here? I mean, we exist in a society, these men, primarily men, got these ideas from somewhere. It's from our society, perhaps from our media, creating a climate. What can you say about our society, our media, that men draw from it, that this is somehow acceptable?
You know, I think the president said it well yesterday in his speech where he talked about this need. We need to have a change in our thinking about this particular form of crime. We need to rehumanize the aspect of seeing other people as objects for us to manipulate for our own pleasure or own gratification. I think there is a great deal of pressure in the socialization of our young men to have sexual conquest and sexual exploits and to sort of prove or hyperprove their masculinity in that way. I've talked with a number of young men who speak of this kind of pressure from their peers. And I think peer pressure can actually be used in a positive way. If we can engage young men and women as well and people of all genders in the idea that the pressure we should put on one another is to keep each other safe,
okay,
we can make a big change.
Linda Stewart-Crone, director of the Women's Resource and Action Center at the University of Iowa, reacting to the new White House report yesterday, President Obama formally setting up a task force that's charged with protecting students. Linda Stewart-Crone, thank you again for coming in.
Very welcome.
It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Well, let's spend the final part of the hour talking about the weather and related things. Let's start with the related thing. The second Arctic blast has barreled through the Midwest this week, and those of us who use propane to heat our homes, not natural gas, are scrambling to deal with sharply higher prices and a limited access to the fuel, propane. Joining me to talk about the propane problem, Iowa Public Radio's Pat Blank. Hi, Pat.
Hi, Ben Kiefer.
How are you today?
I'm good. Thank you.
Do I remember right to use propane?
As a supplemental source, not solely. In fact, research will show that only 10% of Iowans actually use that as their only source, mostly low-income and elderly people who can ill afford to have prices spike 3 times what they were at the end of the summer.
And we're mainly talking about concerns among people in rural Iowa, right?
Exactly.
Mm-hmm. How much have propane prices jumped?
Well, this got my attention starting about 10 days ago when Harold Homas from the Agriculture Department, who sets out a weekly price gauge, showed that the increase was $1. It was $1.99, which is a new record for the state of Iowa. Mm-hmm. And that was 10 days ago on January 13th. This week, it was $2.61. That was Tuesday. And then by yesterday, it had spiked another dollar, $3.61 on average.
So we're closing. Have we doubled? I'm trying to follow those numbers. Have we doubled or more than doubled?
More than doubled in some cases. There are anecdotal reports of people being charged close to $4.
Mm-hmm. So what does that mean for propane users, people who depend on it at least partially for heat?
Well, I talked to Jerry McKim, who administers the low-income heating assistance program known as LIHEAP, and he's getting reports from many of his clients who say that they are out. They're completely out of propane, and so they're using alternate sources. One lady and her children huddling around an electric stove to try to keep warm. So, what also happens then when the heat goes out, then the pipes freeze. So it's just the wheels have completely fallen off for some of these people.
Mm-hmm. How did we get into this situation? What is it? What you've looked into this, I know, and are preparing a report on it. How did we get to this point? Because, cold winters are, well, I guess we've had a few mild winters recently, but that's, mm-hmm. We do have cold winters and we should be ready for these things.
Sure. Well, it was a perfect storm, pretty much. What happened is the farmers planted their corn later, thus wanted to leave the corn in the fields later. And what happened is when it was time to harvest that corn, much of it was wet, and they have to dry that down in big dryers, which use large amounts of liquid propane, LP, which is what we're talking about. And that went later into the season. Usually there's a little recovery time for the propane to get back into the pipeline once again. Well, we had a very cold December. So that started the whole thing. Again, the other thing is happening is we are exporting. The United States is exporting an exorbitant amount of money, or not money, of product overseas. There's a huge demand for propane from foreign countries, and we continue to make sure that they get that as well. And so all of that is working together to cause this shortage.
Mm-hmm. So what else are you hearing from the people that you've talked with? I know that, one aspect of this, Pat, is that unlike those people, city dwellers, who are attached to a pipe, a gas pipeline, and don't have to have propane tanks, this has to be delivered, right?
It does, and therein lies some of the problem. Many of the propane companies, and for good reason, and that is their practice, require a certain amount to be delivered. In my case, it's 250 gallons. You need to order at least 250 gallons. Well, do the math. That's a lot of money. And especially,
oh, yeah, you got to come up with $1,000 or something, right?
Exactly, and it has to be paid. And many of the companies also are not taking on any new customers at this point. So if people are shopping around and they went from one company to another company to another company, they're like, well, we're not taking on any new customers. So it's a really bad situation. So I don't know. I don't know mm-hmm. what's next.
Yeah. Well, what questions do you still have about how this will develop in the future?
Well, I did talk to just got off the phone before I came on the air with you to Bill Brock, who is the head of the Consumer Protection Division at the Iowa Attorney General's office, because some people are saying, this went too fast. The increase has gone too fast, from $1.99 to $2.61 to $3.89 in some locations. There must be some price fixing going on. There must be some scandalous activity happening behind the scenes. And he says their office has had no reports of that so far. If people do think that they're being deceived, if they do think that they're being overcharged and that the suppliers are taking advantage of the situation, they should contact Bill Brock in the Consumer Protection Division of the Attorney General's office. What also can happen is, for example, after the tornado in Parkersburg, after the 9/11 emergency, the governor could declare an emergency, at which time deceptive practices and anti-price gouging would go into effect. But we're not at that stage yet. And I'm not so sure if it's why there's only 10% of the people who are affected by this, or if it's just truly not a problem at this point.
Okay. Any idea on the outlook, the prices staying high, going even higher, or falling, hopefully?
I don't think they're going to be falling anytime soon. One thing that also did happen from the governor's office sent out a press release today, and Texas, which is where a lot of the propane comes from. Texas is now joined on with Iowa, and much of the U.S. Department of Transportation has established a regional emergency declaration. It suspends the time that truckers need to write down on their log books if they're sitting in line.
Mm-hmm.
So it's called the hours of service waiver. The truck drivers are transporting the propane. They don't have to count the hours that they sit in line at the terminal against the actual hours they're on the road. And so that's now a regional thing. It's the Dakotas, it's Minnesota, it's Iowa, and now Texas, from where we get some of our propane trucked in, not through the pipeline.
Okay, we'll try to stay warm and keep our fingers crossed. And, of course, watch out not to employ any dangerous methods to keep warm if our propane runs low. Iowa Public Radio's Pat Blank, of course, host of All Things Considered. We'll look forward to your further reporting on this, Pat. Thank you so much.
My pleasure.
And to wind up the hour, we want to take a look at the weather, how it's developing and will develop in the next few days. Bitter, dangerously cold wind chills continuing through at least the middle part of today, and today's highs, I think, something like -5 to -10 above in certain parts of the state. Joining us to explain what we'll call a roller coaster of temperatures, Kevin Scow, meteorologist for the National Weather Service out of the Des Moines office. Hi, Kevin.
Hello.
Hi. What's causing the frigid temps this time? The same as before, that polar vortex?
Yes, you could call it that. What we call the polar vortex is sitting up in it's actually an area of low pressure that sits in Canada, and we're wedged between that and an area of high pressure over the West Coast, which is bringing California all that really warm and dry weather you may have heard about. And in between there, we have northwesterly winds that are bringing all that cold air from Canada right down into Iowa.
Mm-hmm. Now, there's another funky name that's been thrown in here, Alberta Clipper. What is that?
An Alberta Clipper, as the name might suggest, is a weather system that originates out in Alberta, and it tends to set up with these type of weather patterns where you have this northwesterly winds. And what happens is these weather systems develop, and they're very quick-moving, and they skirt down through the Dakotas and in through Iowa generally. And there's not a lot of moisture with these storms. They generally don't drop much in the way of snow, but they can bring these very high winds that we've been seeing across Iowa. I know many people have been talking about the high winds. It seems been very windy across here, and that's what these Alberta Clippers tend to bring. And they also tend to bring in this very cold temperatures, and that's what happened yesterday. We had an Alberta Clipper slide through the state and brought that very cold weather right back down into us.
Mm-hmm. What causes these very cold winds to come down? What is drawing them down?
It's just a matter of it. These systems originate way up in the north. They originate up in northern Canada, where obviously there's much colder air. And so these weather systems can tap into that much colder air in the north and just draw it down south. There's not much in the way impeding that cold air.
Mm-hmm. We asked one of our lists, we tweeted that we'd like to find out what are the positive aspects of the cold weather, Kevin, and we had an answer from a Lindsay. I'm sure camping will be less mosquito-ridden than the last summer after how cold it's been. You're a meteorologist. I don't expect you to know the answer to that, but maybe you do. I don't know.
It's a little tough to tell. I know the soil temperatures have been below freezing down to below 20 inches, so obviously a lot of insects below the surface that tend to hibernate over the winter probably have been killed off. So there is probably some validity to that statement.
I think we'll have to stay tuned to future Hort Gang discussions to find out what the effect of that is on our summer and our spring. How unusual are such temperatures, the temperatures that we'd be having this time and that last incident we had with the polar vortex? How unusual is that for this time of year in Iowa?
While these temperatures are below normal, they aren't exactly rare. We have seen cold spells before here in Iowa. Some people might remember back in the 80s, we had some particularly cold spells where temperatures in Des Moines dropped down to -26 during the winter of 82. And other periods, such as the 1994 and 1996 winters, were also very cold. Even just looking at the average temperature from December through the middle of January, our year only stands at around -6. We've had colder years in 2000 and even 2009 as recently. And it might seem that we've been a little spoiled, you might call it, because of the very warm winters we've had back in the winter of 2011, 2012, and the winter of 2012, 2013. In fact, some of our record highs in Des Moines for January were set back in the winter of 2012, where we had highs in the mid-60s in early January.
So our skins have thinned out a bit, maybe, is what you're saying, Kevin.
There's certainly something to that, yes.
Okay, we've got about a minute left. What's in store for us in the next few days?
Well, you kind of hit it on the head earlier when you said we're in for a roller coaster ride, looking for temperatures to rise quickly back up into the low 30s to even mid 40s in southwest Iowa here for Friday, and then we'll see a couple bouts of snow on Friday night into Saturday, and again Saturday night into Sunday. And after that storm system on Sunday, another Alberta Clipper, we'll call it, another brown of cold air comes down, looking for temperatures to drop down into the single digits, the teens below zero, and wind chills back down to 20 and 30 below for the beginning of next week. So again, it's a roller coaster ride we're going to be on.
Mm-hmm. Will this tell us anything about what's going to happen later in the spring or in the summer, anything at all?
It's a little too early to tell. This upper level pattern that we've been seeing hasn't really shifted much since the fall, so it's probably a fairly decent bet that this will remain kind of the norm through the winter, or below average temperatures with maybe a bit of a respite every now and then. For the summer, it's a little too early to tell.
Okay, we'll check back in with you. Kevin Scow, meteorologist for the National Weather Service out of Des Moines. Kevin, thanks so much.
Hey, thank you.
Coming up tomorrow on our program, as we come to the end of this hour, it's a News Buzz edition tomorrow, as it is Friday. We'll talk about a recent string of home invasions and shootings occurring in Des Moines over the past 2 weeks. Des Moines Register reporter will be with us to discuss these crimes, possible law enforcement intervention. And also, the EPA is considering a lower amount of ethanol in fuel supply. That'll be a topic of discussion tomorrow. We'll be joined for a segment by Iowa Secretary of State Matt Schultz. He'll talk about his decision to charge 9 more voter fraud cases, most of whom are felons who mistakenly believe their voting rights had been restored. And Iowa ranked recently as one of the most dangerous states to drive in. We'll find out why that's the case tomorrow on our News Buzz edition of River to River. River to River is produced by Ben Stanton, Emily Woodbury, and Sarah Bowden. Catherine Perkins is our executive director. Our theme music written and performed by the River Monks. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.